Welcome back to the Film Experience. This is your host, Nathaniel, and I'm here with Nick Davis.
Hello.
And Joe Reed.
Hello.
Katie is, she's very pregnant.
She's very pregnant.
Which is why she's not with us. And hasn't been for weeks.
And also we said the word project, and she was like, what? No!
Today is a special episode. We're going to talk about 1996. Speaking of projects, Nick's been doing his revisiting of the Cannes Film Festival. And this is the one that was juried by Coppola, right?
Yeah, and I didn't know until I read... Did you guys see Tim Robey's article yesterday in the Telegraph about five times the Cannes juries almost yelled at each other?
Yes, and this was one of them.
Yeah, I didn't realize how contentious it was. And that picture was amazing of David... Coppola couldn't even, look at David Cronenberg.
I mean, if you had just seen Crash within days of that, I don't know if I'd be able to look at David Cronenberg either.
Okay, but what if David Cronenberg saw Jack, you know?
Or... Oh, I don't even mean about, quality of film.
For those who haven't read the article, Nick, do you want to fill them in?
Oh, just that apparently the jury was incredibly split about Crash, and I don't know, nobody's ever said... did somebody really love it and thought it was the best? But certainly some people really hated it and were horrified and thought it should be run out of town. So they wound up coming with that weird prize for originality and audacity.
Yes.
In lieu of the usual jury prize.
Just to reiterate, this is 1996, not 2005.
Right, yeah. Well, indeed.
Yeah, different device of Crash.
Yeah, I don't know that audacity would apply to the others unless we're talking about its Oscar win.
Yeah. So it would have been awesome if Matt Dillon had just crawled into that car and started making out with her, you know, when Ken was burning upside down.
He was in too deep.
That's right.
Original song joke for you there. Do you guys remember that dance number at the Oscars?
Oh,
not only do I remember, but I watched it in your house. I'll always remember it.
That was the name of the song, right? In Deep or something?
In the Deep.
Oh, In the Deep. Oh, I spoiled my own joke. Nick, did you watch all of the competition films? Is that how you do these revisits?
I did. I found all... Part of why I picked this year was that I was able to find all 22 of those, but I wound up seeing 55 movies total.
Wow. That's are devoted.
So... I have my question for you guys, because I'm talking to a few different people who mm-hmm. are weighing in on particular movies I know they care about, whatever, that'll all go up next week. But I like starting all those conversations with the Fargo, Secrets and Lies, Breaking the Waves, trifecta, and mm-hmm. since that was the trifecta, kind of the whole festival, where do your loyalties fall?
I'm a Fargo man that year. I don't think I was ready for that jelly when it comes to Breaking the Waves at the time. Are we talking about Best Actress or are we talking about the movies themselves?
Well, those concepts are so close to each other, but we can be talking about either or both.
It's true. The three of them were so very actressy.
Yeah, I mean, I remember at the time I thought Brenda Blethyn was a little... overwrought, so to speak. Uh-huh. But then I watched it again and I was kind of blown away. I remember reviews at the time, some review I read had said something about her use of the term sweetheart in the movie, which she says over and over again. That's her term of endearment and or just term. And I, at the time, I thought, well, that's, you know, they're projecting onto this. But then when I watched it again, I think it was just a year ago or something.
Uh-huh.
I was very, completely moved by the performance. And, that wasn't overwrought at all. It was just the character is very emotive.
Yeah.
She's a mess.
Yeah.
Whenever I think of that character, I always think of her just sort of, face soaking wet with tears, kind of... you know, trying to cope with whatever revelation has passed through previously. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just sort of that sweetheart thing being such a term of endearment, like you said, but also this defense mechanism of, you know, familiarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at the
she
time,
actually used it in her Golden Globe speech, so she knew it was a whole thing.
She had her own catchphrase.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if catchphrase can be one word. Emily Watson at the time, I need to see the movie again because I'm actually considering doing a Von Trier retrospective, God help me. But it's amazing performance, and speaking of audacity and awards for audacity,
yeah.
But it's one of those performances that the role itself is so big,
yeah,
that the performance of those three that I've always thought was actually the best is Frances McDormand's, because there are so many ways where that character in anybody else's hands could have been less than it is. And I think it's so iconic because of how controlled it is and how smart she is about all her choices in that movie. And it's such like a tiny arc, but like it's so calibrated to perfection. I'm still in love with that performance 20 years later.
It's amazing to me, you know, when you think about like the story of 1996, that those three movies ended up being, you know, such major Oscar players, and that trying to sort of imagine to graft onto this year, like, any three competition films from Cannes this year to end up, you know, transferring over to the Oscars. Like, it feels like such a rare thing. And obviously 1996 was a year where, like, the studio stuff really collapsed in on itself. That was sort of the story all that year, was like, you know, the indie studios are coming to, you know, steal your babies or whatever.
Take your prizes away. Yeah.
Yeah, seriously. Which was like an amazing, that was when I was still very sort of young and very early into my paying attention to the awards season, you know, phase of my life, which will never end.
Phase.
Yeah, exactly. and I think if we're talking specifically about like me picking a favorite among the three, it's tough. I like them all so much, but like it's boring, and yet like I gotta say Fargo, because Fargo's one of like my top two or three movies ever. But Breaking the Waves is, I only saw that for the first time very recently, and I have a, you know, up and down relationship with Von Trier too, but I loved that one.
Well, Nick, did revisiting them, do your allegiances ever waver that year?
They did a little bit. Well, partly because there are a couple other movies in competition that are like as good as those three, so that's crazy. But also, I did wind up thinking, well, I've always kind of had problems with Breaking the Waves, and I remember when I walked out of the first screening just being so enraged by the bells at the end.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, that's such a bitchy little gesture on his part, right?
Well, I couldn't really read the tone of it, like, but I knew I didn't like it. Like, it just felt like her story had gone so far and then was suddenly totally recuperated as a conceit of his, which I couldn't tell if it was respectful of her or facetious or what it was, but I knew I didn't like it. And so I got in some giant snit. Mm-hmm. And I've been sort of up and down on it, but and there are still things about it that don't sit as easily with me, but I think this time I was just so staggered that anybody came up with this. Mm-hmm. And not just like the craziness of the narrative, but the visual concepts and the music, and like that this community is where you would set a movie, and that everything is actually serving such a completely strange vision, that I was pretty bowled over. So that and Fargo wound up pretty even. Mm-hmm. For me, Secrets and Lies maybe suffered a slight bit. I hadn't actually watched Fargo in a while, but the leaning on the Minnesota stuff, which never really bothered me before, was a little bit in the sweetheart territory of, mm-hmm, just there are some moments in the movie that it is hard to not just see that it's pimping that stuff out for laughs a little bit more than I remembered. But I think they're both totally incredible. I've usually been a McDormand voter, but I think I'm Watson now, just because I couldn't imagine looking at that script and coming up with that person. Like, where would you even start? And yet, it's just like that performance has somehow always been here or something. I don't know.
So you said there were other movies that were just as good. I mean, besides Crash, which is amazing, actually.
Yeah.
What other ones?
And P.S., I will answer that question, but I'll also say I'm a little surprised Marianne Jean-Baptiste was not like an equal player in that. If anything, I like her more than Blevin in that movie. I think it's kind of incredible what she does. So there was a Romanian one called Too Late by this director and playwright and writer. I think he's a novelist also in Romania, who I think is pretty big over there, called Lucian Pintilie. He did a movie called An Unforgettable Summer with Crispin Scott Thomas in the 90s, which I think might be why people know him. But so he's just a little bit before the huge generation of Romanians we know better now. But that's a pretty amazing one about a coal mine in Romania just as it's being kind of moving out of communism, and guys keep being murdered down there, and they can't tell if it's by like a disaffected worker or a monster in the mines, or if the company's doing it to people. And so that turns into a whole crazy thing below the earth, but also all this nutty social drama on top that's kind of comic about what's going on. And then this Ho Sao Hsien movie, and I know that we all struggled at different levels with The Assassin last year while admiring it. And this was, I think, the eighth or ninth of his that I've seen. And it's called Goodbye South Goodbye. And it was the one that I finally kind of totally felt like I got, I guess. It's sort of about, it actually would pair pretty well with Fargo. It's sort of about hoods who have big dreams for themselves in Taipei and no idea how to actually pull them off, but nonetheless culminates in some similarly spooky, violent confrontations among people who you don't think are going to turn on each other.
So overall, with the jury prizes, do you think Coppola's jury was insane, or are you okay with a lot of their choices?
I mean, it does look, when you look at the list of prizes, like they were trying to divvy things up among the same three movies we're talking about, and then with the you know, weird crash cabal, whoever that was. I want to think it was Aiko Ishioka,
right? Of course. I was going to say that. You know?
And I guess Adam Egoyan was pretty on record as being in that crew, too. But Greta Scacchi, is she a crash voter? I don't think so, but I don't know. I don't know her. Yeah, except for the ridiculous Best Actor prize to the Eighth Day, which is this, like, I didn't really know what my life was about until I ran into this person with Down syndrome in the rain on the street, and he humanized me. Like, oh my God. And do you remember that Renee Zellweger movie where she was in the wheelchair and Forrest Whitaker?
Well, I didn't see it, but I remember its existence, unfortunately.
How dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you bring that movie up?
I will say it's worth seeing because of the sheer, like, there is a movie with originality and audacity, but in a different way. but yeah, all kinds of like weird animated inserts and kind of crazy Amelie stuff while the character with Downs humanizes everybody around him. This is the Eighth Day. Yeah,
this is a Daniel O'Toole, who's usually such a great actor too,
and he's totally good in that way that, like, you know, when people say Tom Cruise in some way impresses them more in Rain Man, like, it's harder to have to play opposite the, you know, the characterization that the movie is built around. So yeah, the jury prizes make sense to me, but it's just incredible there was so much to pick from, and then even when you leave the competition, there were so many things that were just as good as those were. Like, just an amazing year. So what else did you guys watch?
I had seen, you know, several of them before, you know, like, I loved your piece on Ridicule, because I remembered that pretty well, and, what was the other one you know, I was big into Gong Li forever, so Temptress Moon, of course. I don't remember Temptress Moon all that well. It came away empty-handed, right?
It did, and it wasn't booed or anything, but kind of felt like the back of the pack to a lot of people, I gather.
Yeah.
It looks amazing.
Oh, well, yeah. It kind of goes without saying with that era of Chinese exports. Especially the ones that starred Gong Li.
I'd never seen it before, and I'd only seen Farewell My Concubine, although quite a long time ago, and I remember Farewell My Concubine seeming kind of ceremonially ornate, but kind of stiff in a way that's on purpose. And Temptress Moon is nuts. That camera is going everywhere, and like, canting and tracking and like twirling around, and it was quite something to see.
Yeah.
So I'll rephrase my question about what other movies do you have feelings about?
Yeah, when the Uncertain Regard, that had quite a few.
Yeah,
Irma Vep is amazing.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Obviously, I've since become, you know, a pretty big fan of Assayas, and but yeah, there's a lot. Like, I just shot Andy Warhol, is one of the sort of great. I always feel like it doesn't get its due in terms of American indie movies when we talk about that kind of 1990s Miramaxi revolution. I thought that was really fantastic.
Yeah, and I'm also a huge Pillow Book fan, of course, because I love Peter Greenaway in general. Like, I was really excited.
Oh, calling Ewan McGregor's penis. Okay, that's
cool. No. I actually love Peter Greenaway. So,
Peter Greenaway is what he calls Ewan McGregor's penis.
It's like
a Carlos Danger thing.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of that one. And then even the films out of competition that year, Nick, I think you and I are the only ones that like Girl 6 by Spike Lee.
Yeah.
I have to admit,
every time I watch it again, I feel like it's a less and less good movie, but I'm still weirdly loyal to it.
And then Microcosmos is actually my cat's favorite movie. Which also played out of competition that year. It's the only movie that I think he watched all the way through. He was just staring at the TV the whole time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this wasn't just like his thing where he swats a DVD out of a pile and that's his favorite.
No, he actually sat there and like stared at the screen.
Wait, this is the one about the bugs?
Yeah, it's the documentary about bugs, and it's used these like called macro camera. But this movie has all these like close-ups of bugs moving around. He was really into it.
Some of the things bugs do are not okay, it turns out. I'll say that. But snail sex, Jesus. That's a whole complicated endeavor that the movie really lays bare for us.
It's totally worth seeing if you haven't seen it.
It's totally worth seeing.
Worse about sex, bugs in Microcosmos or Lars von Trier in Breaking Away.
I feel like the combo of those two movies led us to Isabella Rossellini's TV series.
Yeah, there we go. That's a better joke than mine, which was going to be that I think Udo Kier is where those two things converge. Like, kind of an insect, kind of a Trier. I have a question for you guys about, because I feel like I never respond as fully as the culture intended me to, is Trainspotting. So where does that sit for you two?
I love it, but yeah. I also haven't seen it in maybe 5 years.
Okay.
But I it's still maybe my favorite Ewan McGregor performance.
Okay.
Wow. And, okay.
Yeah. Which is not to say that I'm looking forward to them revisiting it.
Oh, yeah. I keep forgetting.
Yeah.
That seems like a bad idea to me.
I don't know. There are moments in that movie that really do stick with you.
Yeah.
I view that movie as one of those things where it's... I like it, but it's one of those things where it feels more... like sort of an object than a movie to me. Like, this is 1996.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. Like,
very much so.
Like, it feels like part of the culture in a weird way, even though it wasn't like a huge hit or anything.
Watched so much MTV during this era. I was like, that was probably my like number one go-to channel. And it's funny to think of, because they used to be very sort of culturally aware beyond just
music. Yeah.
And, like, much more so than they are now, which is funny that they still do the MTV Movie Awards, because it's like, oh, for one day we're going to remember that, like, there's a culture at large that we're sort of part of, where they felt, like, much more part of the culture back then. And I remember, like, even during, like, MTV News, where they would just, like, they would talk about Trainspotting, and they would talk, like, that Iggy Pop Lust for Life video or whatever would play all the time. And I remember, like, they would do, like, an Oscar special, and, like, John Norris would, like, rep for Secrets and Lies. It was very much part of the culture then, and I just remember Trainspotting feeling very much like a huge part of the culture, even though it was this, like, indie movie from this heretofore unknown director. And Ewan McGregor became like instantly massively famous. It was a cool moment in time. And I was like, and I was 16 years old, so like I could not have been more impressionable.
Yeah.
So
I had the soundtrack on, like, I listened to it so much, I can't even imagine how much I listened to it.
And it's amazing how much the movie listens to it. Like,
yeah.
Those songs play out almost in full, even when that means they spread across multiple scenes. You know, like, just the CD is on.
And what was our name for Ewan McGregor's penis? Because that applies here, too.
Peter Greenaway? Yeah, Peter Greenaway.
Really. Peter Greenaway has several cameos.
Peter Greenaway totally shows up. It's true.
One movie I did watch, rewatch recently, was Flirting with Disaster, which really made me nostalgic for the old David O. Russell. And I know it's sort of like, it's almost glib to talk about him in the sort of like before Silver Linings Playbook and after Silver Linings Playbook kind of way, but it really does feel like a different director and certainly a different comedic sensibility. And I don't know. I liked how like acidic that comedy used to be, especially with like the parents and stuff like that. And it was like crazy, but also very sort of sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Like Mary Tyler Moore in that movie is just like merciless and, and it's treated sort of mercilessly. And yet like she comes across so strongly.
It's true.
It's funny when you're like, I revisited this and I'm like, has it ever gone away? I watched that a lot, actually, that movie.
Yeah.
I think it's so, so funny. It's one of those movies that I remember seeing in the theater for the first time, like, really clearly.
Yeah.
Me too.
I was like, what is happening in front of me? I was just loving it. And I didn't have, like, a lot to go on. I had seen...
Spanking the Monkey?
I had seen Spanking the Monkey, but it didn't, like, really make an impression on me. It was this is like a weird indie, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, I sort of went to it just because it, you know, looked silly.
Uh-huh.
And I just loved it. And,
And I had no, like, previous experience with David O. Russell at all. And I just remember that movie was sold very much like a mainstream comedy because it was Ben Stiller and it was, like, very kind of widely advertised. And I didn't see it in theaters, but I did see it when it came onto DVD. But I remember being very surprised the first time I saw it, that it was that, you know, off center in terms of like the mainstream comedy that it was sold as.
Mm-hmm.
Tay Leone licking her wedding ring is one of the best spontaneous gestures I've ever seen in a movie. Like,
yeah.
Just hilarious.
But if you say licking with Flirting with Disaster, you know where my mind goes.
I imagine. We're different people, Nathaniel. You're disgusting. I mean, I think that's definitely one that I always think of myself. Like, the further I get from rewatching it, the more I convince myself that I love it. And then I still am so totally charmed by it and like watching the actors have summer vacation and have fun with each other. And then also realize that there's like four identical scenes where Ben Stiller and Tay Leone have an awkward conversation that leads to a sudden erotic grip that leads to breaking something. or that I'm surprised there's still like a half hour of the movie to go once they get to Lily Tomlin and Alan Alda, because I think of that as like the big hilarious finish, but then there's a whole lot of shit to get through at that point.
Right.
So like as a movie, I find that I wind up docking points while I'm watching, which I think was always true, but the best stuff is so good that it's what I always remember when I think about it.
Yeah, I did have a one Can movie I specifically wanted to ask you about because I haven't seen it, and I generally really like his movies, but A Self-Made Hero by Jacques Audiard?
Oh, yeah. Have you seen that, Joe?
Which took the screenplay.
It did. It's interesting. Like, so, the Jacques Audiard that I know, and I'd never seen this one before, even though it was the first time I heard of him, but I thought the title sounded really boring because that was how I judged movies in 1996. That title sounds boring.
It does sound boring.
It does sound boring. It's not like the grotty, super intense Jacques Audiard of all the movies that we've seen more recently. It's a little bit lighter and just on the edge of being whimsical, even though it is about this guy in France who's pretending that he's a military hero and a resistance fighter, even though he's neither of those things. And so the movie does take some serious stock of it. And one interview I did that'll go up this week is a friend of mine who's our age, who's French, and I was just curious how all the French titles like that and Ridicule and the Desplechin movie actually went over in France. And she says that this story of kind of claiming military and resistance valor when you had none was certainly a huge talking point for quite a while when that came out in France, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was a screenplay award that was a little bit more for, like, I mean, the direction is a lot more interesting and tricky than I felt like the script maybe was, and the premise of the movie I felt a little more provocative than the execution. There are other movies that seemed a little more impressively written to me in the competition, but it's good. It's hard to find, though. Like, a couple of these are.
Yeah, I mean, because the one right after that was Read My Lips, which is when I, you know, got into him and just loved him, and then it beat my heart, skipped, put me over the edge.
Totally. Same narrative. And I would have thought from those, even before you get to A Prophet, that this is in Deep End, that this is somebody who's totally about criminal underworlds and really intense physicality, and there's not as much of that. And then one more I was going to ask you about is Lone Star, because I felt like if Fargo and some of those others we were discussing, it was amazing how many of these movies just held on and dominated a critical conversation for the rest of the year, and it was almost like there was one too many of them and something had to fall out a little bit, and Lone Star still did well and got some screenplay prizes and stuff, but it doesn't feel as well commemorated now as I feel like it deserves, and I was wondering how you felt about that one.
I have to plead the fifth on this because I haven't seen it.
Oh, really? Oh, I feel like you would love it.
I've heard people say so often how good it is that I should. But I've never been, like, really devoted to John Sayles. I'm not against him either. I just have never, like, it's never, I've seen a handful of them, and they just never quite make me a fan, even though I like all the ones I've seen. The first one I saw was The Brother from Another Planet, which I didn't really get at the time.
I've never seen that one.
And then the one I've seen the most is Passion Fish, of course.
Well, sure.
This is very actressy.
She Beast of the Gulag. that one and Lone Star are easily my favorites of his too. I mean, in general, I feel the same way you do. I usually feel like I'm learning something for better and worse, you know, more than diving into a movie exactly. But I like them most of the time. But Lone Star is, trying to think of who else has a career like this, where one of their movies are basically similar, but one of them was so amazing that you kind of keep extending benefit of the doubt to the other ones. this is like definitely the proud centerpiece, I think, of his portfolio. Well, then I'll just make one more plug. This single movie that I feel like if you haven't seen it, you should see it right away because you would adore it. And I think a lot of people listening will love it, is Love Serenade. Did you see that Australian comedy?
I did not. I've heard the name.
So it won the Camera d'Or for the best first film that year. And it's about two sisters who live next door to a disc jockey in a really small town in Australia. And they're both competing to be his girlfriend immediately from the moment he shows up, even though he's so weird that he makes Adam Driver seem pretty normal. Like, why does he have gills? As she notices one night over dinner, as he's drinking something, and it starts to ooze out of his neck. She's like, what? And so then you're watching, like, among many other things this movie is, and it's kind of like Sweetie or Holy Smoke or that kind of Jane Campion comedy in a way. Even without the fish conceit, which I knew about, but doesn't kick in for like an hour, it's just a hysterical kind of one of those semi-outrageous Australian comedies of misbehavior, in a way. And watching two women convince themselves that this guy is for them, and even when they start to notice that he might be a fish, you can look past almost anything. You know, it's like that Mia Farrow, like, well, he's fictional, but you can't have everything. Like, well, he might be an animal, but that's okay. It's so funny. So Love Serenade is my big crowd pleaser pick from all the ones that I watched. And it's on Amazon, so I'm sure it's on Netflix and pretty easy to see.
Is the part where we talked about Crash?
No, we never did still. I don't know what to say about it. I also remember seeing this in the theater very, very specifically because I took my new boyfriend at the time.
Wow. When, what
goal in that choice?
What?
What was your goal in that particular choice?
It's just that I wanted to see it, and also I kind of feel like, I mean, I've, you know, been settled down for a long time, but back when I used to be like someone who dated, I feel like going to the movies and, you know, is a good litmus test for your compatibility with someone.
Okay, but there's going to a movie and and there's going to that.
Yeah. I mean, I saw Waterworld with another boyfriend, and
man, you are just picking them right and left.
When we left, he went on and on about how amazing it was, and I'm like, nope.
You gave him a fake phone number, and that was it.
Yes, but anyway, but I just thought he was such a good sport about it, because he was totally willing to discuss it afterwards. Like, he was, obviously his taste level was more mainstream than that.
Yeah.
But he was, you know, so willing to give it a shot and discuss it afterwards, and I was like, okay, this is a good one.
I
and then
had...
he banged you in the leg.
Oh my god.
It's a good story.
I had not heard of this movie at all when it was new. I think that was probably the level of awareness that I was at, that like Secrets and Lies, Train Spotting, Breaking the Waves, yes, but like Cronenberg's Crash, no. And so when it showed up probably a year or two later on free Canadian TV, which growing up where I did, we got a couple of the Canadian stations. And Canadian stations after 10 p.m. could show uncensored R-rated movies.
Okay.
So I watched one, you know, one Saturday night. I was home and I was flipping through the channels, and I saw this, like, intense sex scene between James Spader and this woman, turns out to be Deborah Kerr Unger. And I was just like, ooh, okay. Like, thank you, Canadian TV. Once again, you've delivered. And it kept delivering, and it kept delivering. And from Holly Hunter's boob to Rosanna Arquette's leg vagina, there was a lot going on. But it was also one of the very few movies that my teenage self was able to watch that had, like, a, you know, two guys, like, having sex. Like, it was, like, it certainly stopped short with those two more so than it did with the other characters.
Yeah.
But it was a very kind of telling signpost along my way of just like, oh, wow, okay, like, this was... And I thought for a while, I was just like, nobody ever talks about this movie. This must be just this odd little thing that only I know about and I must never tell. And so... That's sort of the mental place that it had occupied for me for so long, because I'd only seen it just that one time. And then, of course, learning later that it was this, you know, famously sort of controversial and, you know, auteurist kind of movie. And now revisiting it a week ago, as I did, I kind of don't like it at all. And I found it very... I mean, it's tough to watch it with the sort of sexual mores of 1996 as opposed to, like, 2016. It felt very... I couldn't see the layer beyond that kind of soft core pastiche of it all. Like, oh, you're trying to be, you know, to have this sort of tone of this kind of whispery, hushed... softcore movie where everybody just kind of looks at each other with, like, you know, fuck me eyes all the time at their, like, you know, leg scars or whatever. And the metaphors seem very big to the point of, like, you know, you get it once, and it felt, I don't know, it felt less audacious now, obviously, but I had a hard time putting myself even back where I was before with the movie.
I mean, it's a hard movie to, like, because it's so gross, you know? But I just...
The snail sex of movies.
Yeah, I just remember, like, the first moment that it really had me was, like, when Holly Hunter opens her blouse during that car crash.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what am I watching? And so the audaciousness, at least at the time for me, was so eye-opening.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd seen Holly Hunter's boobs before, so it wasn't that. It was just, like sort of the level of perversion to it, I think, and and matter-of-factness of that, like the sort of people's sexual proclivities being in some way always mysterious.
Did you find it matter-of-fact, though? Watching it again, I found it very, like, look at how weird we are. Look at how strange. Look at how, you know...
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen
the sex scenes, like, that aren't specifically, like... Like, the scene where he's fucking Deborah Kara Unger, and she keeps being like, tell me what you do to him, and, like, tell me how you would, like, penetrate his anus. She said anus so many times in that scene.
But not as often as she said salty.
Salty, I know! But I don't know. Matter of fact is maybe not the word that I would personally use to describe all of that. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe I mean uninhibited. Although I do remember at the time that I do feel it really damages the movie that he can't go there with the gay sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just because if you're going to make a movie about, you know, perversions, like, you shouldn't really pull your punches if you're not elsewhere.
Right.
There shouldn't be one perversion, in quotes, that is too perverted for you. Right. You know? If you're making a sex movie.
Yeah. All the things you're saying about, like, why is this movie pretending to have a gay element that's not coming out as gay, and yet the desires are also crazy, was, like, literally what made me think of the topic for my book, and is why I applied to graduate school, so I could try to get to the bottom of that. It was all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And here I am today, you know?
So my general question about 1986, what are some movies from that year that are just your favorites? Just a quick list.
Bound is absolutely incredible, and whatever I think of every single other thing the Wachowskis have ever done, I think it's just, like, marvelous, both as suspense and as sexy time.
Cosine, and it's so tight. Like, it is so beautifully plotted and performed. And
Portrait of a Lady by Jane Campion, I'm constantly proselytizing for. It's so much more interesting than you might think. Eddie Murphy's amazing in The Nutty Professor, which I remember thinking the whole movie was pretty good, but I'm all the way behind that National Society of Film Critics Best Actor Prize for him. Way to go, guys.
Really? Wow.
And Jerry Maguire. Just love it. Love it, love it.
All the ones that I really go for are the really sort of obvious ones. I mean, even like Welcome to the Dollhouse, which felt so transgressive back then, and now it's just like, well, God, everybody in my demographic that I exist in now, you know, comes from a place of just revering Welcome to the Dollhouse. And two specific ones, I will say, I've revisited The Birdcage recently this year, and it is so good and so, like, preposterously well handled and funny, just so goddamn funny. And even for its ways that it seems regressive, is in its own way, like, audacious, and in the way that it really sort of examines Nathan Lane's character's sort of, like, performative femininity, it should be remembered for you know, when we talk about Mike Nichols's work, it should be remembered very fondly because I really do love it.
We've talked about a lot of the ones I love. Maybe they're not great movies because I haven't seen them in a while, but at the time I was very fond of Emma with Gwyneth Paltrow.
Oh, yeah.
And Everyone Says I Love You by Woody Allen.
I'd love to revisit that one. That one, I haven't seen in forever.
That one has a lot of rough patches. I mean, Woody Allen. But it ends so... The ending is so beautiful. It's so transcendent. Another one I would suggest, just on a like a understanding 1996 level, I think, besides Trainspotting, is Swingers by Doug Liman.
Oh, yeah. I wonder how I would take that today.
It was very sort of in the moment, like buzzy movie. And it's like, I loved it at the time, but I haven't revisited it. And so I have no idea. But it feels like an artifact to me. Yeah, and then the movie that we didn't discuss that was, like, way up there on my list was Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, yes!
By Baz Luhrmann.
And also...
But I imagine people have seen that one.
Yeah. In this weekend where I have such complicated feelings about whether I want to see The Nice Guys, I'm going to rep hard for The Long Kiss Goodnight, which is my favorite thing that Shane Black has ever been involved with. I think that's such a fun, junky movie, and it's... Gina Davis is having an absolute blast playing, you know, this like kick-ass assassin brainwashed lady.
She's amnesiac, just, brainwashed assassin.
She's the absolute best.
The action scenes are so crazy in that movie too.
Yeah, it's so off. It's off of any kind of, you know, reservation you could possibly have. It's just absolutely thrown out the window. It's phenomenal.
I will say, given how his career has gone since, I really wish that Shane Black had directed that one.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than just writing it.
Although, even, like, I mean, that scene where she jumps out of the window and, like, machine guns the ice so she, like, crashes through it is, like, that's some, like, there's some really amazing, like, visual stuff in that movie. When she sort of goes underwater and she sees the body of the guy under there, and the scene where she's chopping the vegetables, like, there's, for his, you know, Rennie Harlan's a shit filmmaker, but, like, there's some stuff in that movie that's actually really memorable in terms of, like, kinetic filmmaking.
Oh, yeah, the romance of Rennie Harlan and cocaine was a beautiful thing, at least I imagine.